Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 15th, 1996. In the fireside room this evening, our speaker is Daryl Tremieux. Today's session number is 1 and is titled Ecological Ethics, Green Grass or Green Backs? Let's listen in.
My name is Daryl Tremieux. It's spelled oddly. It's phonetically very easy to pronounce. Just as a barber might say, can I trim you? Okay, the title of this session is Greenbacks or Green Grass? Which I think is fairly catchy. You know, you have to have some of these titles to kind of spark people's interests. It's essentially concerning with ecological ethics. In the Christian tradition, we talk about the earth as the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Yes? Well, we say that in terms of our theology, in terms of our doctrine. But if the earth is the Lord's and the cattle on a thousand hills are also God's, what are we saying and doing theologically when we make deserts and denude forests? Because if all of creation is God's, and if through interaction with creation, humanity renders certain species extinct, certain habitat uninhabitable, then we are making certain kinds of claims upon creation. Are we saying that God does not mind what we do with God's creation? That's one possibility. Are we saying that God is all wise and forgiving and will forgive us no matter what we do with God's creation? That's another possibility. Since y'all are real quiet back there and all around here, I don't believe in the banking theory of education, which, you know, teachers supposedly are reservoirs of knowledge and information. And what you have to do is to prepare yourselves for me to transfer these things and bank this knowledge and such into your head. So I'm going to just share some thoughts with you and then open it up really for discussion. And part of what I want to do is to get us to move towards more holistic living and a more holistic ecology. I think part of what has happened in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s is the kind of picture that has been projected of people who are concerned with ecology. You know, they're all Audubon Society members. They run around with binoculars on. They watch birds. They're concerned about tiny fish in streams while people starve. And what I would like to suggest, even, you know, in contravention or distinction to my title, is we should try and avoid false dichotomies, such as greenbacks or green grass. That was just a nice title to get you in here. But actually, it's not a way of thinking about the problem that I really would suggest to you.
Talk about holistic a little bit. Holistic rather than what?
Well, holistic rather than really differentiated. For instance, in terms of worldview and cosmos, in African traditional religion and African culture, it has a more holistic view of reality. The difference between what is sacred and what is secular is much less clearly distinguished than it is in, say, the Western tradition, in which this is sacred and this is secular. And there's a certain kind of compartmentalization of experience, of responsibility, of people, and of projects. And what I'm trying to suggest to you is that a lot of systems that we find to be very important, such as an economic system, political system, cultural system, religious system, and our ecological system, are in fact woven together. And that they're not so easily pulled apart, that we can change things, but we can't essentially change just one thing. that where we change some things, we have a tendency to impact all of it. But getting back again to the issue of false dichotomies, a lot of times that's the way the ecological problem, the ecological challenge, is presented to us. It's either money or environmental integrity. There's never a middle ground. You know, there's never a compromise. There's never a third way. Or it's loggers or spotted owls. You know, somehow you can't have logging and spotted owls. No possible way. Wilderness or urban sprawl, as if there isn't any other way to construct on the earth besides either leaving it completely untouched or building on top of everything. And what I'm suggesting to you is that false choices force bad decisions, and that false choices, sometimes by people who appear to sometimes be ecologically oriented, really finally maintain a status quo of non-sustainability. Because if making any changes absolutely ruins the economy or absolutely ruins a certain kind of way of life, then you really do divert people from trying to find workable solutions. Because it then appears to be impossible to make any changes, so let's not make any changes. Other false dichotomies, humanity or nature. You know, it's kind of an us or them mentality, which I would again suggest to you is a false dichotomy. That, in fact, human beings are, as the Bible makes clear to us, part of creation. You know, in the Genesis story, we are created out of the earth, not apart. So what I'm suggesting also is that extreme opposites do not allow for real fact-finding or real compromises, and therefore also constitute or encourage a non-sustainable status quo. But I think even though there has been this image in public discourse of some of these false dichotomies, certain kinds of ecological issues are beginning to creep through. How many of you saw recently the blockbuster of the summer, Independence Day? Okay.
No. So much for blockbusters, huh?
I guess that movie would never turn a buck if it relied on us, huh? Wow.
It's going to make this analogy really rough.
In the movie.
It just came out. I mean, give us more.
That's true. Without giving away all the plots, you do know it's about an invasion of Earth by aliens. I don't think I'm revealing too many secrets there. And I won't even tell you how it comes out. The point, though, is that somehow these aliens were not ecologically responsible and therefore found it necessary to travel across the universe from wherever they came from and to attempt to conquer our planet. Similarly, you can see it in popular culture in another movie, which you probably also haven't seen. Another bad analogy. How many of you have seen The Arrival?
All right, thank you. Thank you. Okay, now I really do recommend you to go see that, because that movie is very ecologically concerned. And in which, again, there's an invasion from aliens. And I'm just wondering, you know, is this a pattern for one thing? Who want to take over this planet and do so not by direct assault with science fiction weapons, but by changing our habitation, by speeding along certain forms of pollution and global warming. Okay. And then, you know, since I don't think you're going to go see it anyway, I might as well tell you. One of the aliens is asking, you know, why are you doing this? And he says, well, you're doing it anyway. We're just speeding up the process so we can get on it while the getting is good. That's essentially his argument. So I think some things are beginning to creep into our public consciousness with regard to the issue of ecology. So I would say that, you know, false dichotomies, we need to be on our guard against them. We are not over and against nature, but part of it.
And when we, you know, when you read Romans, it talks about creation being in travail and needing to be redeemed, but all of creation is redeemed. It's not humanity is redeemed and creation is cursed. You follow me? All of creation is redeemed. So I think you have in the scriptures a clear indication that we are part of God's creation. We may be a distinct and special part of God's creation, but in every respect, we are part of God's creation. Then we again have some false dichotomies, global warming or alarmist reaction. And I'd like to acknowledge Larry Rasmussen, who teaches at Union Theological Seminary, for an essay that has stimulated my thought. You can find it in a publication called Moral Issues in Christian Response, in which he talks about certain kinds of challenges and also about certain kinds of risk-taking. And one of the important points of the essay is that trial and error has been a widely accepted process in which truth is discerned, particularly scientific or instrumental type of truth. And what he was saying is that when this methodology is adopted or brought to ecological concerns, it has the potential for disaster. Because trial and error does need a period in which certain things are tried out, and in which the error is then recorded, and usually also has to be repeatable. But if something like global warming really is going to melt the polar ice caps and therefore flood most of our major cities, we don't want to employ trial and error because of the potential of catastrophic results.
You missed your chance to ask who'd seen Waterworld.
Two strikes already. I'm also running out of time, so I decided to quit while I was ahead on that.
Well, again, a lot of times in terms of Christianity, we have been given pictures in terms of relating to creation in which the images, the root metaphors, the primary roles are domination or stewardship. You know, we domination, be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth, subjugate the earth in some translations. It's kind of an, again, over and against. And I would suggest to you that perhaps even stewardship is an image that gives us perhaps a little too much power and responsibility, let alone domination. Because we are neither purely lords nor purely servants. Well, I need to rush on because otherwise our discussion is going to be truncated, to talk about systemic possibility. And again, Dr. Rasmussen raises certain kinds of challenges which I think we need to talk about. The first is a kind of political challenge. And what he posits, I think rather persuasively, is that ecological concerns are growing so important as to have certain kinds of major political impacts. Namely, whether or not we really are one Earth, therefore perhaps we need one global policy. The clearest example of that are some of the developments going on in the Brazilian rainforest, in which we know that a lot of the fresh air we breathe is manufactured down there. At the same time, Brazil wants to develop itself and therefore needs, or feels it needs, to cut its rainforest. And, you know, we are a stop since we cut our temperate forests from saying to them, well, no, you can't really develop your country, even though a lot of your people live in poverty, because we need that air. You see what I'm saying? And because their reply can very easily be to us, well, that's exactly what you did. We're following your developmental model. So, you know, it's something we have to consider. It seems to me, and here's how it all connects, the political challenge and the economic challenge. Perhaps we must say through the IMF or through the World Bank, you don't need to really cut your rainforest because there will be perhaps forgiveness of international debt. Okay. Because we recognize that this is one planet and that we are connected and that you do need to get out of debt, but we also know we all need to breathe. So that's one of the political challenges, and it makes us ask the question, who is creation for? Who owns anything? Who has a right to possess and control things? And especially, it brings to our attention the limitations of the nation state. You know, it makes us ask how we are one. Garrett Hardin, for instance, is a significant writer who has very important essays about what he calls lifeboat ethics, in which he draws this picture of wealthy nations being in a lifeboat. And he wants the insurance of a margin. So he says to poor nations, nations in the South, says for us to have them remain in the water and tread water as long as they can and or drown. Because his whole idea is one of, again, an us against them mentality, that somehow we don't contribute to to ecological problems, other people do. And I think that whole business with the rainforest shows the limitations of that kind of characterization, which we're all in the water, and there are not some who are safe, so to speak. Well, I must rush on to the economic challenge. How can you have, as our economies are structured, unlimited growth on a limited planet? Okay, and most of our economies are geared that way, that for us to maintain a certain kind of standard of living, we must continue to have our economies grow. Yet we know we can't expand this planet, and we know it has limited resources. I'm amazed. I'm from Newark, New Jersey, and Newark has one of the best, particularly colonial, pre-colonial libraries. And I used to go down there and pull out an old volume and see that in Newark, New Jersey, when it was first settled, in around 1630, that salmon swam up the Passaic River. And if anybody's been in Newark, salmon swimming up the Hudson or the Passaic River is almost unimaginable. Yet, if we talk, there are a lot of us who could talk about what it was in our lifetime, differences in ecological and environmental changes. I was speaking today with a woman who lived in Phoenix who talked about how the mountains surrounding Phoenix you could see it almost every day, and now it's rare days that you can see them. This is all within one person's lifetime. So it's something for us to think about. The main question to ask here is, what is an economy supposed to do? Isn't it a subsystem of all human living systems? Do we work to live, or do we live to work? And it seems to me that finally an economy has to be for people rather than against people, and for a sustainable system. Well, there's the religious challenge, and I think part of that raises the question of a kind of religious salvation through science. And that makes us ask, what is creation? If creation really is arbitrary, if creation is just some sort of exploding dust, if nature really does not have any telos, any end, any destiny, if, for instance, evolution is just, fighting the various species evolving and contrasting each other, then it seems to me that there really isn't any end and there really isn't any purpose to creation. Well, I'm not against evolutionary theories and I'm not into creationism. But what I am suggesting to you is that finally scientific explanations of reality are insufficient. And that's becoming more and more apparent as we come to the limits of what scientific inquiry can tell us. So that finally you begin to notice that scientists talk in faith terms. And what I'm suggesting to you is that those terms probably are the ultimate ones. Well, then finally we have our cultural challenge. How do we change things without changing things? Which is what most of us want to do. How do we change things? And let me throw out again two, you might call them false dichotomies, or you might call them two ends of a spectrum. There is one approach towards relating to the environment, culturally speaking, the kind of Australian Aboriginal way, in which what they take pride in traditionally is that they've lived 40,000 years on that particular continent without changing it. Their great accomplishment is that no footprints. They have not left any permanent marks. Well, that's one end of the spectrum. Then there is the modern military industrial Western way in which, again, very much related to Christian notions of subduing the earth, the notion that somehow science is going to bail us out, and that what we have to do is stay on top of things, continue to manipulate things, that we always can stay one jump away from catastrophe. And what I'm not giving anybody any answers. I love this. I don't have to give you answers, you know. What I have to give you is questions. And what I'm suggesting is that we have to try and find some way between these two. I don't think we can necessarily go back to a pre-modern aboriginal way, but I know that we also can't continue what we're doing. And so finally, what I'm suggesting is that what we need to talk about is a third way, a new culture which perhaps does not leave the world untouched, but which does begin to ask questions about how things should change, what is the impact of change, and what are our responsibilities, particularly over time. And we still have what, 20 minutes? What time is this at? 7:20? Oh, we have more than that. Oh, okay, good. This is wonderful then. All right, well, now everybody's still awake. Let's talk about it.
I think one aspect of the overall problem is population. Obviously, there can be a runaway in population. I think the Chinese people face this problem. I'm not sure they solved it. But if you do have a population, let's say, that goes exponential, you're going to have exponential problems. That can just throw on the table for discussion. I think something should be considered to have a win-win type situation where population control or population awareness is in the formula.
Well, that's a good point. It seems to me that in the Western, particularly in the English tradition, Richard Malthus came up with notions of problems caused by population control. And again, historically speaking, one of the responses Malthus had was he was against the English poor laws. And he believed that the best way to help poor people would let a certain percentage of them simply starve to death, because they then would not reproduce more poor people, and therefore would not exacerbate the problem. And people like Lord Trevelyan in England still demanded that the Irish export food from Ireland during 1848 and 1849 Irish potato famine, which is why you had over a million Irish come to this country, and over a million Irish died. So yeah, it did keep, you know, it did solve certain kinds of population problems in Ireland. And I don't by that mean to say that I'm taking your point lightly. I think population control is something we have to deal with. But I guess I would like to point out that part of, in terms of ecological problems, part of the real problem is the use of energy more than it is the use of land space. And in modern industrial societies, we use huge amounts of energy. And so you've had some people from countries like China and other countries that don't use a lot of energy per capita in comparison say, well, look, you cut back on your energy consumption and we'll try and work on our population. So I think you're right. We have to do something about population control. And this is where the problem really comes in, particularly with religious systems in which to have large families is considered to be religious duty. It's a serious problem. Yes.
The reference to overpopulation and ecological problems is an apt one, though. When you study wildlife biology and wildlife population dynamics,
mm-hmm. you find that Malthus's theories work very, very well. And in the process of propagating, you know, freely, a given wildlife species will in fact degrade its environment, its habitat, to the point where the population is no longer sustainable and it will collapse. And when you look at wildlife, you have a situation where each individual is, of course, by nature seeking to maximize its take from the environment. Each deer in a starving herd in a snowed-in deer yard in the winter is by definition seeking to maximize its nutrition from what is there. Mm-hmm. And when you look at us, even though we are quote-unquote created in God's image, we are doing essentially the same thing with our environment, because we, let's face it, we are each seeking essentially individually to maximize our individual return. We measure that today in terms of dollars and toys, and but in fact we are perhaps driven by the same eye thrust as any other creature. The only difference is we have an almost infinite ability to rationalize that, whereas they don't even think about it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's we a very also interesting have the point. Opportunity, though, to do it differently. We can think.
But to do that, you have to get over that issue of rationalization. And we, I mean, gosh, when I go down the road at 80 miles an hour across Montana, and, you know, I may be thinking, boy, this is burning a lot of gas. But do I slow down to 55?
Yes.
Sometimes, yeah. But do we? In fact, how many people that drive me across Montana drove at 50 or 55 miles an hour?
Did you check your mileage? Because I actually checked mine, because I always heard that thing, and by gum, on 75, 80, I got the same mileage.
What kind of car do you have?
Well,
because I know mine doesn't.
I wanted to inject a more optimistic note that may give some hope for the human race on the population issue. I understand that when women in third world countries gain education and knowledge, and their situation becomes more more open and more educated, that they have fewer children.
Well, there have been some studies, along those lines.
There's some populace.
Sure.
I'm not sure that's enough, but and I care intensely about wilderness, and I'm very worried that wilderness will no longer exist when our population increases at the rate that it's almost sure to increase.
Well, now I think you're darn tootin' right on that. The question is, though, what to do about it? I mean, you know, the clearest example, of course, is beachfront property. You know, everybody wants beachfront property. Because to have, you know, property at the beach is so aesthetically pleasing. But of course, you know, someplace like Coney Island is not aesthetically pleasing. You know, once everything is spoiled and overpopulated, people don't want that.
Chelan County hasn't figured that out yet.
Well, I'm from New Jersey, and we have a long history of spoiling beaches. So, I'm sensitive to that. But the question, again, is always one, again, of policy. It's one thing to recognize a problem. It's one thing to recognize bondage to a certain way of living, a certain problem, and it's another to overcome it. And so, again, I'm not providing you with any answers. I'm providing you with more questions. Go ahead. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I'm sorry. In order to achieve this, you would almost have to have a dictatorship, because you can't appeal to people. to use less and do less. And you would also have to limit medical abilities so that people don't live to be 100.
Well, so again, people seem to be characterizing our environmental problem as being primarily a population problem. And I would like to suggest to you that it is primarily a habitat destruction problem, over consumption and improper consumption of energy problem, more than it is a population problem. Not to say that population is something that does not need to be addressed. Yes?
Well, let me pursue the energy conservation question a bit. I happen to, with my modest knowledge, think that's a key issue. Could Holden Village function, exist and function as it does if energy conservation or consumption in this society was brought down to a globally sustainable level?
That's a good question, and that's both the technical and political and spiritual question. Holden Village does some things that I think are good, ecologically speaking.
To get to the point quickly, you came here from Fort Worth, Texas, mm-hmm. and there are people here from the East Coast. That's an enormous consumption of energy on behalf of leisure time.
Well, I always like to think it's spiritual and renewal, too. it was leisure time there. Yeah, I suppose if people really did get at it differently, did not travel as often, because that does consume a good amount of energy. And yes, I confess, I travel more than the average American, and therefore consume, I'm sure, more travel energy than the average American. One of the things I think we have to do is to have more renewable energy resources. I know some people are working on flywheels for internal combustion engines, in which you can basically charge them up electrically and then use them to power vehicles without polluting the atmosphere. Of course, to generate that energy, we'd have to make better use of things like wind power and water power and solar power. And it sounds like I'm now gravitating towards some sort of technological solution. I think your point and your criticism is well taken. It does strike me, though, that, and here I bow to the wisdom of local Lutherans, I'm not sure whether or not there are enough Lutherans in Washington to sustain our village life as we know it. And I also believe that if each one of us, and in each one of our communities, begins to address public policy differently, that we can compensate for the energy we consume coming here. But now I'll admit I could be wrong on that. It is an important point. Yes, sir.
Well, it's interesting that you you lay out the energy issue as the limiting factor on the growth in the world.
Well, it's one of them.
Yeah, but it sounds like it's more of an overriding limiting factor than space and that sort of thing.
Yes.
And the interesting thing about that is that the economies in these largely overpopulated countries are expanding very rapidly. We're kind of worried about population control, but what's happening is that economies are expanding in China and Thailand and all these third world countries. And as that happens, what do? They consume vast amounts more energy.
That's true.
And so really it's gonna become a crescendo that we probably can't control. Because again, who controls their energy consumption, who controls their production, etc. We don't. And we don't have the option to do it. So you sort of paint a picture that becomes a little bit scary as you start looking at that. And really, how much difference can we make as Americans? Do we have much control over that situation? It's just like the rainforest in Brazil, except it becomes it's moving much faster.
Well, that's a very good point. As a lot of these countries do jump the gap and become first world countries, they will, if they follow our example, that is, mm-hmm. consume a great deal more energy. And part of what we could do is to create new paradigms here
for those who have not achieved our technological and industrial production to perhaps live differently.
Then we could export.
Well, I mean, we could model differently, because nobody is going to tell China how to develop their country. They're going to do that themselves. Everybody, okay, go ahead.
Well, I think let's go back to the old 55 versus 80 scenario. The rest of the world is developing at the pace that it is by selling essentially luxury consumption goods to the United States, to us. And so when you talk about Thailand developing, you're really talking about policies in the United States that go back to the end of the Second World War, when a policy was set that we were going to make the rest of the world recover by opening U.S. markets to anything that anyone could manufacture and sell.
Well, I'm not going to quarrel with you on that, although I'm not sure in complete agreement on that. But let's run with that. What are you suggesting is what I'm trying to.
That again, it goes back to our taking our own foot off the accelerator. It goes back to our controlling our own consumptive desires. I had the opportunity this spring to spend a week in Washington, D.C. At a seminar put on by the Brookings Institution about Congress. We met with congressmen, we met with congressional staff, and a lot of these kinds of things that you're talking about are considered insoluble because we, the people, won't vote for people who get serious about ecological problems and about fiscal problems. We won't vote for them. And you look at the way that they're pandering to us now in the upcoming election. And it all still boils down to the choices that we make and the understandings that we carry forward of.
Well, I think you're quite right. That's why I come and teach it all that. And try and get people to think differently about these things. Yes.
Me? I can't think of the fellow's name now, but I heard a thing on public radio where he was talking about a lot of research done in recycling. Like if a company, for instance, sold a rug, they'd have to take it back. Mm-hmm. That was part of the agreement and would be put into the cost accounting of that thing.
Sure.
And if then again, though, the politics of the thing, we would have to push for those kind of people who would elect those kinds of laws, and we wouldn't have all this stuff thrown into the landfill and more energy. And he's not a very positive. I can't think of his name.
And this is done in Germany.
Yes, and he said that, right, exactly. He said it was being done in those countries in Europe because they really have to. They don't have landfill spaces. That's right. That
over the life of a product, whether it be a washing machine or an automobile, the manufacturer is responsible for this item. And so that when the person who buys it is done with it, he turns it back to the manufacturer, and the manufacturer has to recycle it or whatever.
Yeah, and in a lot of municipalities across the country, there is by law, Fort Worth, where I live, you have to recycle all paper and all clear plastics.
But your automobile, do you have to recycle that? Mm-hmm. Does it go back to the manufacturer?
No, not to my knowledge. Yes.
On the pragmatic side, there's a theory about social change that emphasizes what's called small wins, which these are some big examples of big wins. But in the city that I live in, Portland, Oregon, we also have very substantial public recycling. I don't think it's quite mandatory in the way you're describing, but the public support and cooperation throughout that metropolitan area has been really very remarkable, very positive, very high level. And so the solid waste problem has been reduced very substantially, not eliminated by any means, but there's been a major impact. the last few years on that. There's also, on this issue of cutting back, taking your foot off the gas pedal, there is an outfit in Portland called the Portland Earth Institute that is conducting education campaigns to promote voluntary reduction of consumption. And they're getting a quiet but wider and wider audience in that area. And there are people who, it's run by people who are volunteers who are just simply committed to the notion that we can't wait for political solutions, we can't wait for economic solutions. And their aim is to persuade people to make these kinds of commitments and can carry them out on a voluntary basis.
Very good, very good. Yes, over here.
I want to make a point about what it's going to take to do this. And I don't want to return to population except as an example. Families in undeveloped areas are going to continue to have large numbers of children as long as they think it's economically sustainable. It's worth their while to do that. In order for us to make it not worth their while, we'd have to make a new kind of economy available to them, which would work, but it would cost enormously. Now I want to come back to the thing that you said. What we want to do is to make change without really having to make any change. Here's the change we could make. We could offer sustainable, workable, practical, locally generated economies in these areas if we were willing to pay for them. But we're not willing to pay for them. And we're not going to become more willing to pay for them by reducing our own consumption. As good an idea as that is, it's not going to make the United States more willing to export its resources to other nations to prevent them from using up the scale of energy that we're using up.
Well, let's assume that helping these people is an answer to the problem. You basically said that we don't have the political will to do that.
That's what I said.
Okay, I wouldn't argue with you over that. I guess my question to you is, how do we generate that will? If that is probably the best or one of the main solutions.
I don't know how we generate that will. I'm just here to bring you the question.
What I suggested earlier, though, and what Dr. Rasmussen's article suggests, is that the non-sustainability of our current programs will generate, hopefully before things get catastrophically out of hand, better political work.
But that's the politics of humanity, and we are crisis-oriented, and we probably won't do much until the crisis is staring us in the face.
The tragedy is we have the will to ship billions of dollars worth of armaments to third world countries, but we don't have the will to cut back on that and use the same amount of resources to build up their water systems and their sewage disposal systems and their ability to produce their own food and housing. We're not willing to do that. But we'll be willing to provide arms so they can murder each other.
Well, I quite agree with you. Go ahead.
Just on a personal level, we know, for instance, that in Mexico, more and more people can't afford the basics of rice and beans because the land is being used to produce the pineapples and the mangoes. But how many of us go to the store and not buy produce from Mexico? Because, you know, I mean, to me, buying produce from Mexico is taking the land away from people that was used to build, to grow the beans that they can afford to buy. And because we are willing to buy produce from Mexico.
And we have fresh flowers, don't we?
Yes. We get all this. And I mean, I'm just saying, on every day we make choices.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, I studied with Jose Miguez Bonino, and that was one of the major points that he... But on the other hand, we stop buying Mexican produce. What about the people who, the Mexicans who do produce that, who then begin to starve?
But most of it, the pineapples, the bananas, whatever, is owned by Dole Corporation that we have stock in.
Yeah, go on.
Okay, I'm just saying, if we weren't paying the high prices for that produce, it wouldn't pay Dole to own that land. And it would probably be put into production for rice and beans again.
Well, I don't, you know, I was right up to you to the I'd like to think it wouldn't be, you know, it would be put into production with rice and beans. I'm not sure that it would.
Take a look at land reform, though. They own all the good land down there, and if you had land reform, the individual little farmers would be able to produce their rice and their beans or whatever.
Well,
but they can't
true.
Get their hands on the land because of this situation she just described.
But I'm just saying, on a daily basis, we aren't willing to make that choice. So how, as a country, are we going to make these huge choices? That baffles me.
Well, you're not by yourself.
Yes.
Well, just on a level that actually saves money, saves energy, or people are not willing to carpool. You know, my husband and I often remark to one car, one person. We live in the Seattle area. There's terrible traffic jams. One person in one car. They're not willing to carpool. They even make it easier on the freeway. You can go faster in the carpool lane. And it would really save money, and it would save energy. And it's such a simple thing that wouldn't cost you anything.
Okay, but now let's talk about this, because I think you're onto something there. How many of us have heard a sermon that was ecologically oriented that talked about the duties of people said to carpool? What a conserve water. So see, I teach in a seminary. Does that mean that we really have failed in theological education?
Yes.
I'd say so. We're trying to turn it around.
That goes back to the Apostle Paul's statement that we as Christians are going to seek out and obtain the kinds of preachers that we that fit our rationalizations. It's very difficult. It's very difficult for a pastor to say those kinds of things in a parish and not
keep his job.
Get off at the knees.
Yeah, but again, now everybody in this room is not a pastor. For those who aren't pastors, you have to be willing to say that you're going to back up your pastor if the principle is correct, including principles that deal with issues of ecological concern. Against other people in your church who, for a variety of reasons, aren't willing to make the sacrifices that this woman talked about. So, I mean, I think it's important that we do change theological education,
but you see,
that we do create a generation of ministers that are concerned with these issues, but each one of us pay tithes, go to church, can support our ministers.
And well, the real point is that as congregations, we do not teach our children the meaning of domination and the conflict in interpretation between the first chapter of Genesis, go out and wrest your livings from this, and the second chapter of Genesis, where we're charged to treat this world like a garden. We don't.
Yeah, but there's no law.
But
there's no law against that.
No.
Okay. In other words, there are things we can do. We've talked about it pessimistically.
Aren't always doing it.
Okay.
The church grows, you have to have a bigger parking lot.
When the church grows, you have to have a bigger parking lot, so you
can
take down trees.
Well, what I'm beginning to hear is a consensus that part of what we need to do is we need to change as Christians and demand those kinds of changes from other Christians, and the recognition of these problems by our churches. Is that... or am I just making that up?
That sounded really good.
I think I hear that around the room, because there are a lot of people with good ideas here.
Do you try to get an adult forum and have anybody turn out to listen to it in your churches about social issues like that?
It has been done.
It's pretty hard, I tell you.
Yeah. I think we need to take a look, too, at who is going to, what generation is going to be there to follow us and implement this kind of thing. And if I don't raise my children with these ideas, the next generation is in big trouble. I think it goes back to the schools. I think we have to be active in pushing this with our own children, teaching our own children to stand up for these issues. And because we are going to go away, and they're going to carry through.
Okay, yes.
I think that one of the great roots of the problem, though, is a little bit of what you were talking about in the very beginning, of seeing our place holistically as humans and what that means as far as fitting in our usage. That when we decided that we were the dominant being on Earth, that's when Earth has gone wrong. That if you go back to people who do have that idea, like Aborigines, where you only use what you need at the time, that if we could start thinking more that way. And I know when you were saying about an animal will, you know, will use what's needed, but I think the difference between the animal and the human is we don't stop at that. We produce and we use and far more than we would ever need. And even in agriculture, that possibly we did not export so much agriculture to third world countries, that this idea that we have that we are so important and we are such stewards of the earth that we're going to feed everyone, I think it's going to be our illumination. That when mankind really really developed agriculture, that was kind of the big problem, as I see it.
Well, there still is a lot of arable land that is not under agriculture. Mm-hmm.
But we're feeding, as long as you know you can feed your children, you're going to keep having more kids. I mean, that the only time that population really dropped in the United States was during the Great Depression. People were careful about having a lot of kids because they knew it might be difficult to feed them.
Feminicide has changed in terms of our becoming more industrial, more city. I mean, my mother and father came from much larger families.
But during the 30s, that is the only time it ever drops. What I'm saying is when people, the statistics show that, that is when population in the United States did drop, that people made a conscious effort to, because they knew what the situation was. Well, it's so easy now. You know, everything's available. And the more that we continue to send our grain and feed the world, we're just using that in many ways.
Yes, I see the point.
I'd like your opinion on another concern I have. It seems to me that our population has grown, what, 5 or 6 times in the 20th century, and we'll do the same in the 21st. And a large part of this population is in poverty. And where there is such poverty, there is malnutrition. And where there is malnutrition, there is mental illness. And to assume that we can continue this way very long without violence disrupting the whole thing and making impossible any world government or whatever is going to be the answer. It concerns me. I'd like your opinion.
I think we have a lot of violence right now.
Right.
If you think again of the two world wars, you're a lot of that is, you know, it's not just the Germans didn't like the French in terms of French culture. You know, when they took over Paris, they drank enough French wine. It was an issue of Lebensraum, you know, living space.
I'm thinking of the magnitude, just the past 50 years, the population has grown so rapidly, and the poverty and malnutrition is so great.
In our own country.
And these haven't even, and around the world, and these and the young people haven't grown up yet. I mean, this.
Well, yeah, it's a problem. It is a problem we have to address, and it is connected with economic problems, political problems, and I guess that's one of the points I'm trying to make here is that these problems are interrelated. That there isn't an ecological problem over here, an educational or nutritional problem over there. And oftentimes we have sought those kinds of solutions. You know, we throw a little money over here, not analyze the whole system, and hopefully that'll take care of the problem. But somehow that'll filter through all the levels of the system and work it out. the issues I think are coming upon us more rapidly as we, as you know, countries do develop, as populations continue, and as the consumption of energy continues. So that you do have a great deal of emphasis upon finding some kind of technological or scientific solutions. And I'd like to probably begin to wind this down with a caution for us to think, or to be careful to think, not to think that somehow these problems really can just be solved through some sort of scientific solution. I know a lot of people got excited, for instance, with coal fusion. You know, oh wow, you know, if we can do that, we really can have a lot of energy. We don't have to change how we use energy because we can just simply generate a lot of energy without degrading our environment. And that may, I don't know, I'm not a physicist, maybe that will happen. But I don't think it will. And it seems to me it's dangerous to begin to think of relying upon magic bullets, so to speak, to get us out of our problems, you know. I don't think there's going to be a kind of ecological penicillin shot that is just going to cure it and, you know, really just knock that problem out. But I've been told to begin to wind down so that we can go to chapel. So what about two or three more comments and then we'll have to wrap this up. Yes.
One of the things I find very hopeful is I think oftentimes what happens is that we find ourselves facing a predicament, facing a crisis. And out of that crisis, there is a common meeting of minds in which we ponder possible solutions. And out of that pondering, we generate alternatives. And I think it's very exciting to see that there are a lot of alternative ideas and alternative resource allocations that are developing in our society. And I guess the question is, are the changes occurring fast enough to avoid, you know, a major crisis? But I think, you know, we focus so much and depended so much on the political system to provide the solution. We elect our officials, and they have the answer. And the answer really resides, I think, within each of us, making our own individual decisions and taking our own individual responsibility for our world. And then in common, trying to solve some of those problems that we face.
I'm always for more individual responsibility, yeah. Yes.
I think this all comes down to individual level, individual effort. We live in Everett, in Snohomish County, and the Snohomish County Waste Management, Solid Waste Management, has an excellent MRC program, Master Recycler Composter, which I'm a member of, and we practice recycling, we practice composting, and we share this knowledge with other people, and it's somewhat incredible and almost at a grassroots level, and has done very well in our area.
And even kindergarten kids are taught.
This is something that the emphasis is in. It's beginning at the elementary level, getting kids interested in ecology. So,
that's important.
It's a very positive thing there.
Yeah, but it's very important, particularly when you get them to do it more than just on an individual, voluntaristic basis. When you can get whole communities to come around, that's when I think it comes around. I think you're going to have the last word.
I think another thing that maybe was one of your initial points were the dichotomies that exist, and it seems that dichotomies during this century have gotten more exacerbated. They're, you know, people are much more quick to jump on one side or the other. And one thing that we could possibly do individually is to try to work towards common solutions. If we have to wait for a crisis to bring us to commonality, which it will do, then it's going to be too late. And so what can we individually do? We can individually try to stay away from the far ends of the spectrum on both sides and try to reach workable solutions.
I think you're on to something there, although if you have to be on one end of the spectrum, you'd probably be better off with the Aborigines.
Thank you for your attention. Appreciate it.